Well, hi, everyone. It's time for another edition of Crime Wave, the podcast featuring mystery, thriller, and suspense authors and the stories behind their stories. Crime Wave is part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network with over 4 million listeners worldwide. I'm Bonner Spring, and my guest today is Tim Malini. Tim's the author of the best-selling and multiple award-winning Cape Weathers Mysteries. His latest novel, which we'll be mainly talking about today, is an art heist called Hanging the Devil, which Library Journey in a starred review calls, listen to this, relentlessly fast-paced with delightful dry humor, and I concur. That's not part of his bio. I just concurred. He also wrote the comedic thriller Jump, which Publishers Weekly describes as, quote, a perfectly blended cocktail of escapism. Tim has won the McCavity Award for his short fiction, some of which has appeared in lots of different anthologies. He currently lives and writes at an undisclosed location in New York City. It's very nice to finally meet you, Tim. Welcome to Crime Wave.
Thank you, Bonner. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I'm really excited to get into talking about Hanging the Devil. Now, the tagline for your book is as good a place as any to start. It goes like this. It was supposed to be a simple job. Steal the paintings, leave the forgeries. Uh-oh, what happened?
Things went horribly wrong, as they often do in mysteries and crime fiction, right? So I originally conceived of this story as an art heist, and I knew there were going to be a bunch of subplots spinning off of that, but it was going to be a museum robbery. And the book opens with a pretty dramatic attempt at that using a helicopter. But things go a bit sideways. And there's a horrible accident. A guard is killed. The only witness is an 11-year-old girl who's in the country illegally. She's now orphaned and, terrified. She runs into the back alleys of San Francisco and finds herself in Chinatown, and the story unfolds from there. But on the forgery front, as I did my research, I found that so much of art crime involves smuggling, theft, but yes, forgeries. And I thought it'd be very interesting if they discovered that the thieves in this case weren't just going to take things from the museum, they were trying to smuggle forgeries in. And that changed the trajectory of the plot in a really interesting way.
It certainly did. I've read that that some parts of Hanging the Devil are loosely based on actual crimes. Is that right?
Yes. It was interesting when I started doing the research. I started visiting a lot of museums and watching documentaries and talking to people, and as you'd expect, reading a bunch of books and researching the art crime division of the FBI and the specialist police divisions in Italy and France. And it turns out there were a series of crimes in museums going back several years that all occurred in the same way, in the same time frame, related to the theft of art that had been taken by these museums from China, often during the Second Opium War. So it was a situation where there had been attempts to retrieve the art, and then some of those had been diplomatically successful, some weren't. And there were a couple of articles that came out about, gee, isn't this interesting? This robbery occurred at this museum in Oslo, and then this other robbery occurred in this museum in England. And the same types of artifacts were taken very quickly, very professionally, in and out in like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And they were tied to some of the initial inquiries into these collections. So I thought that's really interesting. And it got me thinking about the repatriation debate in the art world. If you see artifacts in a museum that are hundreds or thousands of years old, where did they come from? Who owns them? What's the provenance of some of those things? And some of that has a political bent. If you think about, the geopolitical tensions with China, which have been part of our lives for the last 30 years, that are sometimes subtext and not subtext, depending on what's happening politically or economically in the world. Some of these questions about art take on a political context, and I was really interested in art as a means of communication, art as propaganda, art as a source of national identity, and what would you do with that, and who would be involved? A lot of my books have a foothold in Chinatown in San Francisco, and I often have involved the Tongs and the Triads, and it turns out that there is some art-related crime occurring through that lens. So I thought, great, I can just lean into that, and there's a whole world that I can discover, and then that's a big canvas to paint on when you're writing a mystery novel. I always like the stories that seemingly start off with one type of crime that then spiral to the point where suddenly it's a much bigger story and maybe a bigger conspiracy or takes on kind of a global thriller aspect by the end.
Yeah, I'd say you probably do that in this one very nicely. And it couldn't be a more timely topic too. There's a lot in the news right now about Native Americans, their artifacts being in museums. It's been, I think, through my whole lifetime, Greece and African stuff. I was in West Africa for quite a while when I was younger. There was always a lot of conflict about their artifacts being taken to places where they're not particularly well understood. You also dig rather deeply into the I guess I'd call it the nuts and bolts of forgery, which as a I studied art history as an undergrad, and worked in museums, and have taught art history. And honestly, the technology, the ingenuity is really the word I should have used to create forgeries is amazing. Can you talk a little bit about that, Tim?
Yeah, that was an education for me, because you have this sense of, okay, someone's going to forge a painting, and you know, if they match it, great. Obviously, you have to do some things to make it seem authentic. But when you really get into it and get into the science of it, and you think about, you know, art that was created a while back, as opposed to you're knocking off a living artist, a lot of very successful forgers, if you look at the last, 50 years of that, especially if you go back in the last 100 years, we're often creating forgeries of living artists or recently deceased artists. So, this is the lost painting, or they did this, or they did it over here in this country, and we're going to, you know, sell this forgery in that country and get everything right, because it was less one of the known Da Vinci's, or one of the, you know, it required less provenance and maybe less technical analysis. But when you start to get into the bigger question about what's the financial value, what are you going after really? What's the nature of the art that you want to take? And how good do the forgeries have to be? So if you're stealing something but replacing it with a fake, is anyone going to notice? Are the museum guards going to notice or not? And yet you want that authenticity for all the reasons you know. So for me, finding a few forgers and reading about their stories, and there are a couple of great documentaries out there, was absolutely fascinating, because you know, the attention to detail that you think about carbon dating, everything else, what materials are they using for the paints? What were paints made of 100 years ago, 200 years ago? You know, how did they create those pigments? Were they crushing rocks and minerals? Were they crushing insects? What were they using to hold the canvases together? Where do you get the wood from the frames? All of that. And that became absolutely fascinating. And it turns out essential to the kind of crimes that I had conceived in terms of people pulling that off. And the further discovery is that art is still used, stolen art, whether it's real or a convincing forgery, a lot in the world of syndicated crime. It's used as collateral because we can all agree that stolen Rembrandt is worth, you know, $100 million. So I'll hold that in escrow while, you know, you give me the drugs or give me the weapons or what have you. So almost as a guarantee, I'm not going to guarantee my house, but I'll guarantee this stolen painting. And they know that on the black market, they can sell the painting for a fair amount of money. They don't have to carry cash. They can put it in a free port, which is a kind of a tax haven for people who are involved in smuggling. And they also know that they can ransom it back to the museums, because the dirty little secret of the art world is, rather than say we're going to refuse to deal with the thieves, they're so understandably desperate to not have that great painting destroyed, that, you know, out of the eyes of the public, they'll buy the paintings back. So all of that opened up possibilities for me in terms of, okay, who's involved? How are they going to pull this off? What have they done before? And how do I get this right? And there are a couple of characters who develop a pretty meaningful relationship that are involved kind of, in one case, unwittingly, another case, unwillingly, with creating the forgeries. And figuring out how they would do that and how they would go about it as a process was really fascinating.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. I'm so glad you brought up characters again, because I don't want to stray too far from the story of Hanging the Devil, which is absolutely dynamite. Now this, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is Cape Weather's fifth outing with Sally.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay. And they're so much fun together. They really are. And Sally takes more of a center stage this time. You alluded to the little girl who saw the murder when the when the museum was open. And when Sally finds her, she's trying to teach her how to, I don't know, how to stay alive, basically, how to protect herself on the streets. And Sally is something else. I guess I want to ask you, your dialogue is so crisp, and it's, I think, a big part of what makes Hanging the Devil shine. Is there any secret to how you craft it?
I've always felt much more comfortable, I think, with dialogue and think of it as action. I think of it as movement. If you think about, you know, your favorite movies that might have really rich dialogue, but also a lot happens, you know, with the characters, or maybe it's an action movie that just has great dialogue. You rarely see two people, say, even if you see people two sitting down, you know, for a coffee, somebody wants something, somebody knows something, there's an exchange there, there's a tension in that. Or there's the dynamic which you have with Cape and Sally of people who know each other so well and are so different and yet complementary in so many ways, they finish each other's sentences, or they have a shorthand in the way they talk to each other. And if you think about the way you talk with your family or best friends, there's certain people that you just get in this melodic rhythm with, and the dialogue is crisp, it's cut off, it's very, very natural. And back to the film reference, it's not as if you need to see those people walk separately to the restaurant, arrive at the table, sit down, all the niceties. Then you're always starting in the middle of a scene and you're ending, you know, before it ends. And that's a good rule for fiction writers, is keep things in motion. So I always think about the dialogue as, I'm not a big fan of like big exposition or speeches, of just dialogue. And my experience with people who are fast, who are sharp, who know each other really well and are under pressure, is that those conversations are rarely linear. Their own personalities, their own anxieties, their own sense of irreverence comes into an exchange of information about what are we going to do next, or how do we get out of this? And that's where the fun comes. And it also gets back to, I think, comedic crime fiction. I was talking to somebody about that recently. The characters don't think it's funny because the stakes are deadly serious. That's how they talk, or that's how they react under pressure. And we're laughing, just like when you see Lucille Ball in the chocolate factory. She's terribly stressed. Everything's going, she and Ethel are in a bad spot, but we're laughing. It's a release for us, kind of a thing. So for me, the dialogue is kind of a way to reveal character and a way for us to maybe feel closer to them as readers. And in the course of their talking, sometimes there's some fun ensues.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's excellent. And you made the point, you just made the point, that there's a certain amount of comedy coming out in Hanging the Devil. It's darkly comedic, I suppose, I should probably say, as well as mysterious. So it's a tricky line, isn't it? How do you go about injecting humor into what's essentially really dark subject matter? I mean, you've got murder, you've got Chinese re-education camps and animal experimentation and a little girl, you know, whose life is in jeopardy. Where does the comedy come from?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? If you look at films like the Guy Ritchie films, or a film like Bullet Train by David Leitch, you know, they again, it's coming through those particular characters because, to your point, the stakes are deadly serious. You know, there's horrible crimes being committed. There's you know, murder and murderers afoot. So how does that work? Some of that comes through dialogue. Some of that comes through the different personalities. Some of that comes through just the general notion that the best laid plans always go horribly wrong. And I think that crime fiction is always about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And to your point, sometimes it's deadly serious. I did an event with another writer, and we were going to talk about each other's books. And he just started reading mine, and he read the opening chapter to Hanging the Devil. And his comment was, he said, "I heard your books are really fun and really funny." He said that opening chapter was terrifying. I had to immediately find out what happened in the next chapter because it was so dramatic. It's so gripping. And to your point, there are things that happen. And certainly the notion that there's this girl who's all alone in a city she doesn't know and is effectively lost and knows that now, because she's this witness, and the nature of the people who committed the crime and see that she's there, the folks who were in the helicopter when it crashes, are pretty serious characters. So, you know, it's incredibly terrifying. And writing from her perspective, it brought a great gravity to the story. It's when you introduce some of the characters who have a certain amount of confidence, or on the criminal side, cluelessness. I adhere to the great late Elmore Leonard, who was a brilliant writer. His books were always serious, always about serious things, but always insanely fun because of the dialogue and because he kind of operated on the assumption that most criminals are not rocket scientists, or at least their henchmen aren't. And someone's going to do something stupid like rob a bank and forget to fill the car full of gas. So I usually start bigger action sequences thinking, what could go wrong? What could go horribly wrong? Not because I'm trying to make it funny, but because I think I'm probably that paranoid or neurotic. And then sometimes it goes sideways in a way that makes you smile. And other times it fills you a sense of dread. And hopefully in both cases, you keep turning the pages.
Yeah, well, I certainly did. Could I ask you just, the book titles are unexpected and very interesting. How about if you give us the titles of the Cape Weather series and let all the listeners hear of them, and then talk about how you come up with them.
Sure. Stealing the Dragon, Beating the Babushka, Greasing the Pinata, which is, I think, from a title standpoint, some people's favorite. So Greasing the Pinata, and Hanging the Devil, and Boxing the Octopus. And they are this,
there you go.
You said, kind of this triptych. It's always got the verb, you know, verb and then the noun. And yeah, there's a logic to them. Always, they're based on, the titles always come from one of the characters, and they also come from the particular action or challenge. The book that precedes Hanging the Devil, although you can read these in any order, like any good kind of, you know, mystery thriller, they're written as standalones. But Boxing the Octopus, there is an actual octopus in the book. Some of the chapters are written from the point of view of the octopus. And that feeling that you're outnumbered and outmatched and you're trying to box, you know, somebody with eight arms is sort of the feeling in that book, because the number of different threats and mysteries that unfold as the book spools out, and then when it comes together in the end, it again has that feeling of this is all connected, it's the same entity and everything else. In Hanging the Devil, there's an actual character called the Devil or Mogwai in Chinese in the book, who's a very interesting character in terms of his role in organized crime and why he's feared and why nobody knows who this character is. And the hanging played off a couple of different meanings, some stuff that's in the book from an action standpoint, but also, you know, this idea of art hanging, you know, what are you hanging on the wall? What does that mean? And the sound of it for me, because all my books deal with collisions of culture as well, because you often have crime organizations that identify along. As you know, there's the Italian mafia, there's the Chinese triads, there's, you know, often along different groups. And when those groups cooperate or collide, as they often do in this book, there's some folks involved in the Russian mafia who are very involved in the plot. Their culture clashes are as much part of the tension between the characters and how they do business and how they communicate. And the mayhem of it as anything else. And I like the idea that the titles sound almost like an idiom from another culture badly translated into English, if you know what I mean. Like greasing the pinata or beating the babushka, it almost sounds like something that you might say in that one book takes place in Mexico, another one takes place in Russia. So it's like, what is that, a phrase I should have heard, that I haven't heard before? So there's some fun in that too, I guess. But the titles are a bit sticky. People always comment on the titles.
The record should reflect that I'm laughing my ass off. This is so that's absolutely, absolutely, absolutely funny. I'm going to run to one more thing that I really want to talk about that's fun and funny and idiosyncratic about your books. Your books always feature what I think are called jump cuts, where the end of each chapter segues immediately into the same action or thought or dialogue that you've done to open the new chapter. And for anyone who's listening that does not know what I'm talking about, here's an example. Okay, from Hanging the Devil, chapter 11 ends. I have to read this now, excuse me. So are we going to, this is Maria talking. So are we going to talk to a live Russian, Maria asked, or a ghost? And Kate replies, funny you should ask. Chapter 12 starts out, funny, said the ghost. I don't remember hiring that helicopter pilot.
Okay. Yeah,
and wait, it goes right in. How do you do that? I mean, I found myself like, so here's the deal. You're getting the reader to turn the damn page, right? Is that why you do it, Tim? Because I have to know how you're going to twist it into the next scene.
It is pretty addictive, I've been told, as a reader. I must say it's the way my brain works. My early books weren't as, I think, explicit in the overlapping language, but had a similar jump cut feel because I tend to think very visually. I draw the scenes before I write them. So I think almost in terms of movie scenes, mm-hmm. like where's the camera and from which character is the driving perspective of this particular chapter. So I'm moving with them as I go through it. And back to that lesson of start in the middle and end, end before it ends in each chapter so that people do keep turning the pages. I love books that do that. And I found that in terms of leaving myself an opening as a writer, if I pick up that language, it's helping me not only visualize that character, because in this case, there's another character known as the ghost. And he's a pivotal and very, very mysterious character who takes on kind of an interesting, both I think a very scary, but also oddly sympathetic role at the end in some respects. Mm-hmm. But he, he's referred to there, and then you cut and then you're on him. And in my head, you could see that cut visually. You could see that happening in a film. So then how do I do that in language so that they bridge? And I've always been a fan of those things when, you have two characters saying this could be really, really good. And you cut to two other characters who say this is really, really bad. But they're talking about two completely different things. it just keeps you on your toes in a way. And it keeps me writing the pages. So if it keeps people turning the pages and feels like a continuous story, because all my books happen very quickly. It's a compressed time frame. So everything's happening in real time. Then that's good. That's all the better. Momentum is our friend.
Yes, indeed. Well, are Cape and Sally getting together for another adventure? Are you writing something new about them?
I am. And it has an aspect of art crime in it, but it's goes farther afield. It's going to jump around a little bit between San Francisco and Europe, actually. I would be lying to not say that I am not as far along with the manuscript as I would like to be. I've been doing things like this, talking to lovely people like you, and also I'm really good at procrastinating. But yes, the characters in it, I'm super excited about it. I think I obsess about how a book begins. I must rewrite the openings, 40, 50 times. I think that once you have a sense of a story and a plot, that triggering event is so key. I spent quite a few months thinking about that and researching things around that. And I'm very happy with the opening of this book. So now for me, then that gives me the velocity I need that it stays in my head. And then you start to think about what's next. And as you know, as a writer, then you're telling yourself a story. And then it's finding the time and the motivation to make sure the story is as rich as possible and not letting the research slow you down.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Before we go off the air, Tim, can you let listeners know where to find you online?
Sure. If you would like to know more about how to forge a painting or rob a museum or want to read more about Hanging the Devil or any of my books, you can find me at timmalini.com. That is TimmalEeny. And shoot me a note. Let me know what you think. And yeah, thanks for your interest. And Bonner, thank you. This is so fun.
It's been great. I really appreciate your taking the time to chat today. I hope Hanging the Devil is everything you wanted it to be. And I can't wait to hear what happens with Cape and Sally next. Thank you so much.
Thank you.